wondering what you want to be when you grow up? Have you wondered how to get into a certain line of work and never known where to start? My name is John Manigon. I'm a career fly-in, fly-out worker, working as an electrical instrumentation technician in all aspects of heavy industry, including mining and oil and gas, in Australia and abroad. Given my limited exposure to other industries, I've always wondered what exactly do people do when they go to work. Tune in as we discuss from the mundane to the mind-blowing, and everywhere in between, where we garner insight from real industry professionals living the job. What better place to go for first-hand career advice? So if you're a school leaver or a concerned parent of a school leaver looking for some direction, or perhaps you're having a midlife crisis and looking for a career change, you've come to the right place. Welcome, classmates, to the working class.
G'day, classmates. Today I'm talking to Jimmy Blee. Jimmy has been a stalwart in the super yacht game and a pioneer in the introduction of the concept of leisure boating throughout Indonesia. Listen in to learn about his journey and his ability to reinvent himself. From humble beginnings in North Queensland to Indonesia and back again. Check it out and enjoy the chat. Welcome, 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 Jimmy Blee, to the working class. Thank you so much, mate.
John, it's a real privilege to be part of this wonderful show of yours. I've been following it since its inception, and you're doing a really good thing. I think it's an interesting concept for people to be able to see what different people do in their lives and break it down. It's wonderful. Thanks for being let me be here.
No, thank you, Jimmy. And thanks for the praise. I really enjoy doing it, and really gives me an opportunity to meet and talk to people like yourself and actually learn about what other people do. When we first met, I struggled to put a finger on exactly what you do. And I think you described yourself as an entrepreneur. And for those people who are in the super yachting industry, you've been a stalwart in that for quite some time. But for those people who aren't in the industry, maybe in your own words, maybe you could describe yourself and what you do.
Well, exactly what you just said, Jono. It's difficult to put a label on my journey. We'd like to start way back. Was that my father and mother died when I was quite young, 5 and 7 respectively. And that sort of set the platform for my nomadic and somewhat adventurous life. I did most of my formative boating in the Whitsundays. Mm. And from there, we got a job on a boat called Banjo Patterson, which was quite a famous yacht down there on Hamilton Island. And the owners of a boat called Storm Vogel came on the boat and offered us all a job. Mm. Storm Vogel at the time was being used for the movie Dead Calm, which was Nicole Kidman's breakout movie.
Had Who Sam, else was in that?
Sam Neill and Billy Zane.
Right, yeah.
And they did all that filming in Butterfly Bay up north on Hook Island there. Mm. So that took us to Phuket, which started my nomadic life in Asia. I spent 35 years in Asia setting up boating operations for a boutique hotel chain called Aman Resorts. Mm-hmm. Which eventually led to me forming my own consultancy company, marine consultancy company in Indonesia, which then led me into the super yacht industry. Mm. The first super yacht that I was engaged with was one called Census.
So how old were you when you first went to Phuket?
When I first went to Phuket, let me backtrack and just give you a little background onto that. Mm. I was at the time working on that boat. I came into Early Beach because there was a cyclone approaching. That night I got picked up DUI and I lost my license for a year.
Oh, really?
So I must have been in my late 20s.
Mm.
But it was that combined with the opportunity to go overseas, which I hadn't done. And so, yeah, 28, 29 when I moved to Phuket.
Yeah, so you didn't need too much of a push to leave the country then.
Not at all.
Not having a license. I read somewhere you went to school in Townsville or grew up in Innisfail. Is that correct?
I grew up... When my parents died, I moved and lived with my mother's sister, who lived in Innisfail. I was seven. I was seven when I moved to Innisfail.
Wow.
So I count myself growing up in Innisfail.
Yeah, okay.
What happened there, I went to Innisfail State High. That only took me to grade 10.
Mm.
My auntie and uncle, who I was living with, moved to Ravensow up on the Tablelands. That didn't have a high school. So they pushed me off to Townsville Grammar in Townsville.
Mm-hmm.
I lasted there 6 months. I just couldn't. It just wasn't for me.
At the boarding school.
Yeah,
right.
So I went and got a job and called my auntie and uncle and I said, look, I got good news and I got bad news. And they said, well, what's the bad news? I said, well, I've left school. Oh, no. I said, well, what's the good news? I said, I got a job. And so then I was 15. Yeah. I was virtually making my own way.
Mm.
And through
what was that job?
That job was an insurance clerk for an insurance company.
Oh, of course, that makes perfect sense.
Townsville was a significant part of my life, though, because that got me into whitewater canoeing. And through whitewater canoeing, I paddled every river in North Queensland at varying stages over 5 years.
Wow.
I represented Queensland 4 years in a row in slalom canoeing and got picked for a junior Australian team.
Is that right? Did you ever kayak or was always in the canoe?
Kayak.
Oh, in a kayak.
It was slalom, you know, when you go down through the gates.
Yeah,
It's still an Olympic sport at this point in time.
Because I've done a little bit of paddling myself and I'm aware of the different classes because there's the K1s, is it?
Yes.
That's the one that they kneel on.
No, that's the C1.
The C1. And but you're talking about actual... whitewater kayaking
and through the gates. It was slalom canoeing. In those days it was very, we had a very strong club infrastructure in North Queensland. Cairns here with the Barron just out the back door was a great venue. Tully River, Herbert River, which you're very familiar
with. It's my territory.
I've paddled every river in North Queensland. There's not one that I haven't done.
Did you ever get down to Victoria?
Yes, I did. I represented Queensland 4 years in a row, and the championships were at a place called Dartmouth in Victoria that year.
Right.
So it took me. It actually took me right around Australia. I went to Perth for Australian Championships, Victoria, New South Wales.
And you got into that in Townsville?
In Townsville.
Wow.
There was a nice little club there and a very fanatical group of people.
Mm-hmm.
Still friends, so there's still some good friends to this day.
Mm.
And we used to drive every second weekend, either up to the Tully or up to the Herbert or up to the Barron. Chasing the white water. And as I say, North Queensland, you know, among the many magnificent things about this area.
And the water's not too cold either.
The water's not too cold, and it's big. It's some of the best rapids in the country.
Yeah.
Because because of the geography of the way it comes down straight out of the Great Dividing Range, and nice and steep, nice big boulders, lots of water. It's fantastic.
Mm. Yeah. So you went from being an insurance clerk,
yes,
to some, and you've mentioned the passing of your parents early. So it's a bit hard to say that they had an influence on you getting into the yachting industry as you work now. So going from insurance clerk to yachting industry, is there a story
strange,
to tell?
Yeah, there is. when I was paddling, I got involved in those days, it was called the National Fitness. It was the state-run government agency for sports and recreation.
Mm.
The guy there took me under his wing, and I did a Duke of Edinburgh Award, a Bronze Duke of Edinburgh Award, which was a whole facet of different activities to do. But part of that, I started teaching canoeing to school kids.
Hmm.
And the guy said to me, "Look, Jimmy, you're pretty good at this. You should really go to university and study.
You were good at the teaching or at the good teaching, at the actual...
At the teaching. And he said, you should go to university and study this. I said, mate, I finished school in grade 10. Yeah, no one's going to let me into the university. He says, look, I'll write you a recommendation letter for this particular course. And they take mature age students, even though I wasn't mature age, I was still in my teens. But they will put you under consideration for your past experience.
Mm.
I did that and applied and got into the North Brisbane College of Advanced Education.
Okay.
And they did a diploma in community recreation, which was a two-year diploma. I enjoyed student life that much. I got immediate acceptance into a degree program in Melbourne. So I went after that, after 2 years in Brisbane, down to Melbourne for 3 years and did an arts degree with sociology and leisure administration majors. I got out of the back end of that and ended up on Hamilton Island, which my first job there was activities director on Hamilton Island. From there, I started part-timing as deckhand on the boats and then finally got onto the boats.
It's an interesting progression how, you know, like a lot of people love the outdoor rec stuff and, you know, it's a great pastime, but I guess it's hard for people to draw the line between something you really enjoy as being outdoors to something that you can make a career out of. And yours kind of transitioned you into yachting, but potentially you could have kept working in the leisure industry, yeah?
For sure.
Yeah.
And especially the way the world has gone with, and in particular the Australian ethos, is that leisure is such an important part of the Australian ethos.
Yeah.
Yes, it's oddly enough, as you pointed out, my career and my pastime sort of intertwined.
Mm.
I always took the easy way and the adventurous way. I never sort of was quite content staying in the railway tracks of normality.
Mm.
And I mean, even then, from those early days on Hamilton, you know, once we'd sort of achieved, or once I'd achieved certain, you know, got my class five, what's the next thing to do? I didn't want to be driving boats to the reef and back six days a week.
Yeah.
And that's why when I got the opportunity to go overseas, I took it.
You got your class five. Can you maybe explain to the listeners what that means? What is a class five?
In those days, the marine certification was based on USL, a USL code. And you started off getting a launch master's, moved on to getting a class five. Mm-hmm. And then as you got more sea time and more accreditations, you went all the way up to class one, which is considered to be a pilot, a reef pilot or a port pilot, bringing boats in and out. So class five was the bottom rung. It was needed to operate the boats on Hammer, and that's as far as I did go with my accreditations. As it turns out, living overseas, I drove boats of different flags, and we had Bermuda flag boats. They would write you a ticket. 200 ton ticket. Here, you'll need this to drive this boat. Or Burlese. Yeah, they write you a Burlese 200 ton ticket. I've never used the commercial license since. I still deliver boats. I still drive boats myself. But as I said, I identified fairly early in the piece that just driving commercial boats for the sake of driving commercial boats wasn't exactly my alley.
Not for you. What didn't you like about that? Just
the repetitiveness.
Yeah, it's mundane.
Know, it's you know, it's exciting for a while, but as I say, I was decky on the reef trips for about a year.
Mm.
Sick bags. You know, at 5 meters was the name of the game, and it was just not something that I really thought that was going to be in my long-term future.
Did you get your dive accreditation? And
strangely enough, there's a story with that. I'm sorry, I'm probably going to digress a lot. But,
that's fine, mate. That's what we're here for.
But I worked on a floating hotel called the Coral Cat as the deckie.
Hmm.
And part of that job was driving the glass bottom boats for the guests, driving the tenders for the divers. One day, the dive instructor on board said, "Jimmy, I need you to guide this dive with me. I need somebody to hold the hand of this one of these people." I said, "Oh, no problems, mate. No problems." Threw the gear on, went diving with them. He said, "Oh, you're pretty comfortable in the water." So I dove for the next 2 weeks with him doing the same sort of things.
Mm.
We got back into the barefoot bar on Hamo after the trip. He said, "Jimmy, I didn't even ask you. Well, have you got your dive's license?" I said, no, I don't.
I'm just doing what the boss told me to do.
Exactly. he said, "Well, geez, we better fix that." So he wrote me the ticket and to answer that. Subsequently, I did up to 3,000 log dives over my career.
Mm.
And when I got to 3,000, I looked back and I said, "Who really cares how many dives I've done?" So that was in my 40s. So I stopped logging dives and probably done another couple of thousand after that. So
have you done any of the riskier stuff, like the deeper dives with the special mix?
Not so much the special mix. The only special mix we used to do was drink too much beer before we go and do the moorings.
That's my kind of mix.
Yeah. I was on an island in Indonesia for 7 years as their marine director.
Mm-hmm.
And we had 10 deep water moorings that we had to service all the time.
Mm.
And yeah, as I say, we used to kind of joke, we'd have a couple of stubbies before we'd go down, save getting the narcosis.
Right.
You know, just, but no, I haven't done any tech diving, so to speak.
Mm.
But as I say, I've done my fair share of deep water dives.
Do you still do it now?
Still dive.
As a hobby or more of a work kind of
thing? No, definitely as a hobby.
Oh yeah.
Lucky enough that I often get invited on other people's boats at different times, especially when we're living in Indonesia. Mm. And the fact that all my three kids dive. You know, there's nothing better now than going for a dive with one of your kids. It's very gratifying, and some of the nicest dives I've ever done is with my kids. We were diving in Indonesia once with my son. He was only 10, and a mother and baby dolphin came up to us while we were down there. And I swear this dolphin knew that we were a father and son, because they just went around us and then just swam off. It was one of the most spiritual things I've ever done, to be honest. Wow.
Just making memories, eh?
Yeah. So I still dive. I only dived last week. Had a reef stuck out on the reef. Had an anchor stuck on me. Still on the reef out there.
And the kayaking? You still
kayaking? I still do. We've got. I thought that I would be able to get my kids into it.
Yeah.
It was too hard of work for them.
Yeah.
I've still got three kayaks that at different times I'll try and drag them up to the Barren when there's not a big run and do some. But I certainly, I've got a kayak that I try to keep up to some skill level with.
Hmm. Is there much of that in Phuket?
None at all. No, that was the beauty. You know, COVID has enforced me to be back in Australia.
Hmm.
And during that time, I've realized that Australia is the best country in the world.
Hmm.
And my days of being overseas are over. Yeah. I'm very, very happy to continue living and trying to make a way in North Queensland. We'll get onto that later a bit.
Yeah.
But it's just too beautiful here. The lifestyle is too good, and you know, the lack of recreation, the lack of leisure lifestyle in Asian countries is it really shows to me now that how much I love Australia.
Why do you think that is? Just because it's their poorer nations?
Yeah. Poorer and survival. Survival right, is right, their first and only. You know, they don't have the luxury so much of their leisure is eating and shopping. You know, really, I mean, that's why, you know, after 26 years in the boat industry in Indonesia, you know, the Indonesian government can't get their head around recreational boating. That's why there's no marinas. You know, it's you're either carrying people on ferries or you're carrying cargo. There's no
fun.
You know, the idea to have your own boat is foreign. The idea of a super yacht, of one person owning a 45 to 70 meter boat, they just can't even get their head around.
Yeah, I think I struggle a bit to get my head around that too. All right, so we digressed a little there. So let's go back to what you do in Phuket.
Well, I'm no longer in Phuket.
You're not in Phuket. All right, let's take it up there then.
I moved out of, as I say, I was working for what was then the first ever boutique hotel.
Right.
It was a hotel called Aman Puri, which is part of an Aman chain. There's 23 hotels worldwide. They were the first hotel that pioneered getting $1,000 a room night for a hotel room. It's for the jet set. It's what they seek.
Yeah.
Privacy, luxury, and I set up all the boats. I did all the boating setups for the Asian hotels that had waterfront and had boats. That was a cathartic thing for me because, as this is the working class, I was a redneck from Innisfail. I had never been able to conceive wealth or privilege of that magnitude. The 11 years that I worked for them was the most important 11 years for my personal development, trying to find a place in the world. It really, it was just such a day-to-day learning experience to be providing, and the same thing, recreation and leisure activities via boats and via marine to the richest 10% people in the world.
When you said you were setting up the boats, these were recreational boats where they'd go fishing or water
skiing?
These were the
hotel. When I first arrived at the hotel in Phuket, they had three boats. They had a 45 feet Johnson that came from Taiwan, and they had two Sea Ray Lagunas, which were 23 feet. I was employed to drive the Johnson, and every day we would take guests on private charters. The season was only 3 months long. Then the rainy season came. But during that 3 months, we took the boat out every day with guests. And so, I don't want to sound full of myself, but I took some fairly well-known people out.
Any names you'd
well,
get a
I
name
mean,
drop
the
there?
The highlight, the absolute highlight of my whole career, and was taking Mick Jagger on a 3 day overnight 3 day charter.
So you're,
I mean, that was,
you're a fan.
I was always a fan of the Rolling Stones, but you know, to have one of my idols on board and, you know, asking him how did he want his eggs, you know, was pretty special. It was actually, there's a bit of a story there if you want to go.
Oh, we got time.
I knew he was in the hotel. I knew he was looking at booking a charter. So the hotel manager called me and said, look, Mick wants you to go up and talk to him. So I've immediately weed my pants, right? I've gone, okay. So I've gone and had a couple of beers and calm down,
Jimmy.
So I've gone up to his villa with my charts and with the guidebooks and blah, blah, blah. I've sat down. He was booked into the hotel under a pseudonym called Mr. Rangsit. Don't know why it was Rangsit, don't know what it was, but I've sat down. He's come in and sat down. He said, well, you're the captain. I said, yeah, mate, yeah, I'm the captain. You know, I want to just go through, you know, potentially what we can do. He said, yeah, show me. I said, look, before we start though, I know you from the hotel books as Mr. Rangsit. Do I call you that or what do I call you? Yeah. He said, just call me Mick.
Call me Mick.
Mate, I just dropped my bundle. You know, just so anyway, we did the whole planning and I ended up taking him and his in those days French girlfriend for 3 days. So
And it was just the two of them?
Just the two of them. Oh, wow. And yeah, that was very special.
And did you have crew as well?
I had Thai crew. Okay. And again, what I was doing there as part of what we were doing to set up the boating operation, we were training Thais to be deckhands. We were
to effectively take your job at the end, right?
We were one of the first ever recreational boating operations there. Mm. And we took personal pride in self-determining the ability to be for Thai people to come through and learn to operate boats at that level.
Sure.
So that was I took Kylie when she was going out with Michael Hutchin. I took them.
You met the pair of them?
Yeah. My engineer, my engineer was one of the only ones to have seen Kylie with a top off. She was sunbathing on the top deck, and he came.
He's still telling that story, right?
exactly. My 6 years in Phuket, as I say, that was the level of clientele we were dealing with on a daily basis. They mightn't have been celebrities, but they were captains of industry, huge business magnates. I took the Burmese junta, the six generals from the Burmese junta out for a day. Wow. All they wanted to do was drink whiskey and watch porn on the videos.
They didn't care about anything.
But yeah, so then after 7 years there, I moved down to Indonesia to open a hotel down there, which was on an island off Sumbawa. I ended up staying there for 7 years. The lifestyle was so good. It was such a wonderful environment. And then I started my own consultancy company after that.
And where was that?
That was in Indonesia.
In Indonesia.
And then I've been in Indonesia up until pre-COVID was 26 years.
So what was, the core activity of your consultancy then?
At the time I had, now that we're going to digress a little bit, I'm sorry. There was, in 1999, you might remember, there was the Asian financial crisis. It caused a great deal of economic hardship through Indonesia. All of the currencies were overvalued and the currencies all just fell. I was having to evacuate the guests from our hotel because the Indonesian rank and file were rioting in the streets and burning Chinese businesses. So I had to evacuate. We had six rooms in at the hotel. I had to evacuate them to islands, to Bali, to get them out of the country. I was going across with them and looked in the harbour, and there was the roof of a cargo boat clearly sunk in the middle of the harbour. So I said to the deckie, I said, whose is that? He said, oh, there was a Chinese owner. He ran away and not pay the crew. So I said, let's find him. I'll see if I can buy it. So I ended up buying it for the price of a airline ticket for him and his wife from Bali to Singapore.
And so you bought this sunken wreck?
I bought this sunken boat. Yeah,
I won't call it a wreck.
It was a 23-meter cargo boat. It took us 10 days and 10 nights. Because we'd evacuated all the guests, I had all of my marine crew sitting around doing nothing. So I paid them out of my own pocket, and we filled the boat full of drums, filled the drums full of compressed air, and raised the boat to positive buoyancy, ran it up into the mangroves. It took us 10 days and 10 nights. It took me another year to reconstruct that and rebuild it to being a two-room floating hotel. Of which was the very first boat that we started to use for that hotel chain's Komodo experience. And in those days, again, we're talking about the early 20s, the early 2000s, there was nobody operating in Komodo. So we were one of the first boats operating in there, and that's what I started. I left when that became a viable business option. I left Aman Resorts to run that, and then to manage other people's boats, I just built up a business based on tourism management and boat building for tourism.
So I'm guessing there's probably at this time limited competition?
In those days, there was nobody. Because we were in the forefront.
You would have been
it.
The only one with that Western mindset.
Correct.
We were making money that way.
We were in the forefront of it. Wow. And it was because, again, my whole life, even into the super yacht business, has been based around Amman Resorts and that luxury hotel setting. The business model that I've grown up with and that I continue to try to use in my new businesses is just based on the top 10%. The rank and file marketplace is a very crowded place. If you can find a window into the top 10%, high net wealth owners, earners, it's an easier business model. It's a harder market to crack, but it's an easier business model.
Yeah, in saying that, I listened to a conversation with you and somebody else the other day talking about chartering super yachts per cabin. Now, is this an attempt to make super yachts more accessible to the greater than the top 2% or whatever
it is? It is. Yeah. It is. It's an ambitious business model. If we just flip back.
Sure.
As I was developing in Indonesia, I had my boat. I then built three other boats for the same hotel company. One was a three cabin, one was a five cabin, one was a seven cabin. The seven cabin, they tried to sell per cabin and couldn't do it. It was a market concept that if you've got enough money to charter the whole boat, you charter the whole boat. If you have got enough money for the cabin, there's other ways to spend and explore through marine or through boats. People don't want to be sat at the dinner table with people they don't know. So that business model that group is going to try to attempt here in Australia is going to be a difficult one. I hope for their sake that they could pull it off, because it will give, as you say, opportunity for people who would not normally experience super yacht lifestyle a chance to do that.
And I guess the only reason this is being explored now is because the legislation's changed recently.
Correct.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. No. Exactly. Again, we always have to talk pre-COVID. COVID. Right. On the eve of COVID, the Australian government gave legislative framework for foreign flag boats to be able to charter in Australia. So that was one door that was opening. Since COVID, obviously, the domestic super yacht market with local owners, local.
So just as a ballpark figure, I mean, I've only been exposed to the super yachting industry through people that I've met. For those people who may be considering, say, a next holiday, and as a ballpark figure, if they wanted to charter a super yacht or charter per room, what sort of costs are we talking here for the general public?
They're all very nice. But let's say a 30 to 50 meter super yacht will normally go for $250,000 a week.
And how many people would fit on that?
Well, again, the size, the cabin configuration of that size of boat would probably be anywhere between five with a master.
Right.
And that's where the per cabin thing gets a bit sticky. Because most boats will have a master cabin, I'm talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they will have varying degrees of size and ratios.
Yeah.
So when you're selling it per cabin, you'll be selling at a special price on the master.
Yeah.
Plus, I would think if you reverse engineer the pricing, you would be trying to sell a per cabin on, say, a 30 to 40 meter at about $15,000 to $25,000
for the week. Which, in the grand scheme of things, it's been a while since I've been on a cruise ship, for example. How much do you pay for cruise ships for a week?
I would think that's double. I would think whatever the business model is, you'd want to be double what it is to be a cruise ship because you want the exclusivity. You want the prestige by the pricing, and you certainly don't want to be trying to compete with cruise ship market.
Yeah, and I mean, for people that have got that money to spend on a cruise ship, it's not too much of a stretch to, if this per cabin thing kind of pays off, that you could, you know, have your own super yacht, and if you can get enough friends together with money, then I guess you could have the whole thing just with your friends, right?
Well, that's where it works.
Yeah.
It's where there is a group of like-minded high net worth individuals who say, yeah, let's all chip in and take this for a week.
Yeah.
And that's where it works. And that's why I think it will work on the current Australian domestic market.
Yeah.
As we've probably seen, is that Australians actually spending power with no international travel is a lot more. The whole recreation industry going through the roof at the moment.
Once you figure in international flights for a family, international, you know, accommodations, meals and all that, and if you put it all into a package on a super yacht, I mean, it's quite comparable.
That's why I think it's going to work on the Australian domestic market.
And it's never been done before because the legislation has only just recently changed, correct?
It's a relatively new concept and being driven just on the circumstances, the global circumstances.
Mm. All right. So should we go back to Indonesia?
We can go back to Indonesia. But
let's jump around a bit, Jimmy.
You know, strangely enough, up to the point of COVID, we were running, and it sounds impressive, but it's not really. We're running five companies in Indonesia, all based on varying aspects of marine.
Mm.
Boat management, sales and marketing, engineering services and spare parts, and the super yacht agency.
Refits, or you didn't look after
that? We couldn't. Indonesia is a difficult business model for super yachts because, unlike Australia, there are no marinas, there are no good shipyards.
Mm.
So the only reason people come to Indonesia is to cruise. So we made our marketing, we made our business model based on being able to show owners what they can see in Indonesia and what I call adventure cruising, because it's the Wild West. You know, there's 17,000 islands, incredible culture, incredible scenery, great diving, and we could only attract super yachts to our country based on the ability to cruise.
If I was to put you on the spot and say top three things to see in Indonesia if you are cruising grounds.
That's quite easy, only because these places have everything in this. Raja Ampat, which is out from Papua, it's a cluster of 30 islands. It's World Conservation Protected, we hope, as it tries to be. It has incredible diving, incredible cultural aspects with the local people, and breathtaking scenery. The next one is the Banda Islands, which I'm not sure whether you're up on your history, but the Dutch traded that with the English for Manhattan Island. The Banda Islands was the Spice Islands. And in those days, in the 1800s, mace and cinnamon and nutmeg were the preservatives for meat. And because everything was about sailing around the world and pillaging and getting other people's countries, they wanted to be able to preserve their meat. The Spice Islands at the time were the only place that mace and nutmeg were growing in the world. And they fought terrible battles over them. It was a really bloody history that the final outcome was that the Dutch wanted them so badly that they traded Manhattan Island, that for some reason they'd colonized, to England for them, And they now they're just a rocky outcrop of islands in the middle of nowhere, whereas Manhattan Island is what it is. So there again, the incredible history, incredible diving, and beautiful. There's a volcano right in the middle of it, and then of course there's the Komodo Islands, which is where the dragon is, the famous dragon. Yeah, so those three areas are where we would normally send our bread and butter super yachts. Owners who didn't want to get too far out of sight but still wanted to do adventure. The real adventure owners that we have as clients, we go into the remote parts of Indonesia. The Forgotten Islands, Papua. Yeah, there's still tribes up in Papua. And Halmahera and off to the north of Sulawesi. So, you know, across the board, while Indonesia's 17,000 islands, 350 million people. The 350 million people are quite concentrated in Sumatra, Kalimantan, Java. The rest of the islands, whilst inhabited, is not as sparse and as condensed as those islands.
So the populations that do exist are quite concentrated everywhere else.
Very concentrated. I mean, if you on Java, you can't drive anywhere without without people and people and buildings and stuff like that. So up until pre-COVID, we had these companies fully operating. COVID has killed it. International travel stopped every boat coming. So I was forced to close four of our companies, and we've just written those off.
Closed forever. Yeah, wow.
And I've kept the superyacht agency and a travel agency up and running.
Still without global traffic.
But with probably the best chance of some recovery at some point. And I needed the agency to segue into what I'm doing back here in Cairns. So, you know, where we sort of got to is we're sort of post-Indonesia, and I've ended up in Cairns over COVID with nothing to do.
Right.
And really, I've had to just sit down, and what it's been has been very cathartic. I came to just a running stop, like running into a brick wall.
I mean, by running five businesses in Indonesia, and now you're at this point where you're like
waking up and going, "What am I going to do today?
Oh,
I'm going to go and talk to Jonna." but it's what it did make me realize is that the life I was living, I don't want to live anymore.
Why is that? Because
it was just too madness. Busy. Just, you know, it was high risk, high reward, non-stop work. So I, you know, just being able to slow down and then feel North Queensland for what it is. It's made me realize that this is where I want to be. And we're going to start, or we have started since the end of lockdown, way back in April last year. I've just been looking to reinvent myself over in different aspects.
Yeah, and care to mention what's going on at the moment? I'm all ears.
Well, as you probably know, having a pedigree in the superyacht industry, I've looked at what was going on in North Queensland with the superyachts, and everybody was saying you've got to come to Cairns. Cairns is a great place. We've got the Great Barrier Reef, and that's it. Nobody was really pulling to pieces the destination and putting together programs day by day, be able to present to owners and say, if you come to North Queensland, you can do this 15 days of just mind-blowing adventure.
So still targeting super yacht owners and their super yachts.
That aspect, because super yachts is something that I've been dealing with for the last 20 years, because Queensland, or North Queensland in particular, is on the upward trajectory as a super yacht destination, even more so post-COVID, because Australia is just such a safe country. I always like to sort of, my taglines is North Queensland is the safest region in the safest state in the safest country in the world.
Mm.
And, you know, that will start to transpire once transitional boats start do traveling around the world. That will, you know, owners will say, oh yeah, I'm going to go there rather than going there, so to speak, just based on what I hope is a better understanding of the destination, and from safety, health and safety point of view.
And you being a man with the finger on the pulse, what is the word on the street? Have you've been talking with people that you've worked with, other, you know, super yachts over your past 20 years, and I'm sure you're in touch with those people. People showing an interest in coming.
Word on the street is that most owners are very, very happy to hunker down. I mean, I think the world across the board, we thought this was going to be a short thing and then a bit long. I think everybody's looking at it through a 5-year window.
Yeah.
We're 2 years we're in the second year of what I think is a 5-year window, what a lot of people think. I don't think we will see regular super yacht traffic, pre-COVID traffic, for another couple of years. But for Australia in particular, as I say, the domestic super yacht market is only going to grow. Mm. There was a speaker, I just came back from a conference in the Gold Coast, ASMEX conference. The speaker there, wonderful guy, was in the middle of bringing back 8 over 40 meter super yachts for Australian owners that were in the Med. They're putting them on ships and bringing them back to Australia.
Wow.
So, you know, I think that the local Australian outlook is very strong.
Mm.
Internationally, it's going to still be tough.
I think
the even the top 10% is quite happy to sort of hunker down, keep a reasonably small window of exposure, and take it from there.
Mm. So what else have you got planned around Cairns then?
Well, the other thing that is we're working on at the moment is my son is an actor, and having worked with him through that process, he and I have started a film production company.
Wow. And based here in Cairns?
Based here in Cairns. Like the domestic super yacht thing, Australia, Queensland, and in particular North Queensland as a filming location is only going to become more important worldwide. Mm. We can already see in the Gold Coast the studios that are going up there, the films that they're shooting there. You know, there were 3 films shot here in North Queensland last year. I think that's going to be a strong growth industry.
Mm-hmm.
And given the dynamics of it from a business model's point of view, I think I can find a niche in there on some basis. It's certainly working in conjunction with my son, who's a talented videographer, talented drone flyer, and a talented actor. So we were sort of just, it's more a working under his coattails to get into what I think is an industry that will fit in with the super yachht's lifestyle thing. Mm. If I can start to produce some very good quality destination pieces, if I can do some extra work for movies, get involved with some movies, I think there's a window there that'll see me through the last 10 years of my working life.
Wow. Man with his finger in a number of pies then, eh?
Well, you know, strangely enough, or not strange enough, but ageism is front and center. I always used to look at old people and go, well, he's an old guy, he doesn't know nothing. You know, I'm here now. Yeah. And it's strange that I'll talk to people, not to mention my 3 teenage children, and they'll just say, yeah, Dad, yeah, off you go. So I will never be able to really work again, you know, in its traditional model of going and getting a job, because people just look at me and go, you're too old. So I've got, to get through the last 10 years, I've got to create opportunities and infrastructure.
Adapt and overcome.
Adapt and overcome. And, you know, oddly enough, to go in a full circle, at the end of the day, I have been a survivor.
Mm.
I've worked all through my life with no boundaries or with no parameters and still got here.
Yeah.
With three fantastic children, a wonderful wife, what I would consider a fabulous life. Mm. You know, this is just another challenge to get it over the end of the line. I got three kids now to put through university.
Would you suggest that you've been lucky in life, or you think it's a product of your hard work?
Look, lucky because you've got to be able to identify the breaks when they come.
Mm.
You know, lucky that the breaks come, but you've got to be able to identify them. So it's a 50-50. I was lucky that I got out of Australia when I did and broadened my understanding of the world.
Mm.
You know,
and losing your license had a big part of that.
And losing my license had a big part of it. But you know yourself, growing up in a country town.
Yeah.
I thought at best I was going to be a teacher, maybe go and get an apprenticeship. You know, I never considered going into business for myself.
Yeah.
I never considered, you know, one day having money and one day not having money. Mm. It was sort of, you sort of always think that it's just going to stay on an even, but life doesn't work like that. And being overseas and seeing how less developed countries survive and how people in less developed, you know, that was, again, you come from the lucky country of Australia.
Mm.
To see poverty, and what there is definitely poverty in Australia now, but to see poverty on a grand scale, to see a level of lifestyle that's well below our expectations as coming from Australia, that also allowed me to keep things in perspective on how to move forward and how to survive.
Mm. What I'm finding interesting about, you know, the more of these that I do is the differentiation between, there's people like yourself and me who kind of have a life by accident type thing, and then you've got your people that were driven by ambition. Have you ever, I mean, what would you do if you could have done, like, if there was a goal, an ideal job for you, what would you have picked?
Strangely enough, I've never been driven by ambition.
Mm.
And I've never been driven, luckily, or as you say, luckily, the steps that I've taken have sort of just fallen down in front of me. There's nothing I would like to change about the path. I know you want an answer. I couldn't think of right now. If anything, I would like to be... scratch that. I would have loved to have played State of Origin football.
Oh, really?
Rugby league, man. In this day and age, I wouldn't.
Yeah.
Because of the situation with the game, it's just such heavy contact.
Mm.
But when I was a kid, you know, I used to play rugby league on a Sunday and rugby union on a Saturday.
Right.
And your dream was to play for Queensland.
Mm.
if there was going to be anything that I did, I certainly would have liked to have done that.
Yeah.
I did both my knees when I was playing rugby in Brisbane, so I never got past that stage.
What about some advice for a 20-year-old Jimmy Blee? What would you be telling him if you saw him in the street?
Stop drinking.
Stop.
No, we didn't get onto one of the reasons why my pathway is so checkered. Drinking had a large part of it. I've been sober now for 18 years.
Wow.
And I got sober on the day that I missed my second son's birth.
Wow. Because of your drinking. Wow.
So, you know, that's we haven't even been down that path yet. But drinking took a heavier toll in my life than it did with most people.
Mm.
And that's a whole nother episode.
Yeah. So yeah, it's quite sobering. Can we just talk about recently going down to Skibs, the Century Cove International Boat Show? What capacity you go there in, and maybe just explain to people what it's all about?
No problems at all, Jono. Since I've been in Cairns, I've been blessed to be part of a group called Super Yacht Group Great Barrier Reef. For your listeners, it is an association of 120 Cairns or North Queensland-based businesses who work together to promote the super yacht industry and to promote super yachts to come to North Queensland. The obvious flow-on effect being that the more super yachts that come, the spread of business goes to our key members. Further blessed enough was that I got voted onto the executive board of the Super Yacht Group this year. A very honour. It's a great honour. And we just finished, as you mentioned, a two-pronged set of events in the Gold Coast. One was called ASMEX, which is the Australian Super Yacht Marine Export Conference, which is based about companies who do export, Australian companies which create exports, and super yachts. Mm. All of the members of that are quite extensive. Our group is a member, but you know, there's all the big refit companies, all of this and that. And it was a very good two-day conference. It's the first group or the first public meeting since COVID started of these like-minded industries.
Wow.
Very, very successful. We're really lucky or really blessed to have with the Super Yacht Group a wonderful team from chairperson through to the group manager through to the group coordinator. They're three very driven ladies who put together our representations, and it was a very successful conference. We as a group sponsored the morning tea. Our chairperson presented some of the awards. It was a good high profile representation for North Queensland. That moved on then to the Sanctuary Cove Boat Show, where we as a group had a stand. It was actually on one of the walking parts of the marina.
Mm-hmm.
Again, the organizing ladies who were part of this group did a fantastic job. And the stand allowed all of the members to make their own representations under the banner of the group. And
I actually went down there for my first Sanctuary Cove boat show this year. I must have just missed you, Jimmy. But yeah, it's pretty impressive, eh? Like there's something there for everyone. You know, there's kayaks, there's super yachts, there's super cars. I mean, there was McLarens and Lotus and Lamborghini and Ferrari, and it was
The organizers, the Sanctuary Cove Boat Show has been running for 32 years.
Wow.
And the organizers claim that this year was the most patronized with exhibitors and with walk-through traffic ever in the history of the show. Again, you know, the ability, you know, the country's been on a standstill, you know, lockdowns, states, borders closed, The organizers of both events were extremely lucky because the Victorian shutdown hadn't occurred.
That's right.
So there was still there was still you know, transmittable traffic all through the whole country, and that showed. People came from all over the place. A lot of exhibitors, a lot of delegates, and you know, they got that window. You know, if they had been running it this week, it would have been a completely different story. Oh,
would have been a disaster. Jimmy, one more question. I think in all your years, do you have a horror story? Something that,
mate, I've got so many horror stories the one that sort of comes to mind straight off the cuff. While I was in Phuket, I had just trained a new captain, a Thai captain, to a 55-foot boat. So it was a full Thai crew. They took out a couple of chaps from New York for a full-day cruise. unbeknownst to us, the guy had bought a bag of white powder from the Beach Boys in Phuket, who they sold as cocaine.
Right.
The guy's gone down to the cabin, slapped it up his nose, and done the Pulp Fiction. Bang. Oh, wow. It was straight heroin.
Oof.
He's died on the spot.
On the boat on the which boat. You're a captain.
Oh, on the which? No, I just left my Thai captain take it out.
Oh, okay.
He's called me and obviously beside himself.
Someone's
so I'm down on the down on the jetty. He's come screaming. This guy was 17 stone. And I don't know what it is, kilos in the old way.
What are you talking about? He was six or something, right?
He was as dead as a doornail.
So well over 100 kilos.
And we had to work out what to do with him. You know, we first of all needed quite a few chaps to get him off the boat and into what the best Thai vehicle that we could try to fit him into, starting to stiffen up and all that sort of stuff. We took him back to the hotel and we couldn't report it to the police immediately. We just needed to get some legal advice as to what our situation what our situation was with, you know, a heroin snorting guest and anyway, that whole process was as bad a day as I've ever had. Wow. in the boating industry. And as it turns out, you know, we had to, you know, I was in part of the group that had to inform his family of what had gone on. And
he was an international tourist.
He was from New York.
Yeah. Oh, New York.
And that one of the reasons why we needed to get legal advice was a lawyer.
Oh my God.
So we really needed to tread carefully on that one.
Wow, what a headache. But you came out of it unscathed.
Got out of it unscathed. We did have to put into the contract, please don't buy white bags of powder from the Beach Boys.
From the locals. Crazy. Oh, Jimmy, that's a wrap.
Mate, it's been a real privilege. Thank you. I really thank you for the opportunity to listen to some of my old war stories.
Mate.
And I hope the listeners appreciate it.
Oh, the pleasure's all mine. It's like when I talk to people and people say, oh, no one's going to want to hear my story and I hope I don't ramble too much. I'm like, the more rambling, the better. I love getting those stories out of people. All right, Jimmy Blee. I'll put some contacts up for Jimmy on the podcast page. And thanks again, mate.
My pleasure, Jono.
All right, cheers, mate. Bye.
All of the music on this podcast is written, recorded, performed and produced by yours truly. If you like what you hear, you can find most tracks at my SoundCloud at varying degrees of production. Details in the podcast info. If you're a singer and interested in providing some vocals for any of the tracks without vocals, hit me up and who knows, you may feature on the podcast. Also, if you've got any suggestions or requests for a career which you would like me to cover, drop me a line either on the Working Class Instagram or Facebook page. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss any episodes. Take care and stay motivated.
A big, big thank you goes out to Jimmy Blee. Thank you so much, mate. Today's track is called The Pig Farmer. No reason. It's kind of got an 80s vibe and some cowbell. Who doesn't love cowbell?